Welcome, everybody. We had two shop talks at the last IDF in the spring. They worked out pretty well, and so they decided to bring us back for another round of Ask the Fellows. All questions are taken. It doesn't mean all of them are going to be answered, but at least you have the opportunity to ask the questions. So my name's Steve Pawlowski. I'm a 24-year Intel veteran. I run the architecture and planning group for Digital Enterprise. Pat's my boss. Roughly a 600 to 700 person organization that's responsible for all our processor, chipset, and board architecture and planning within the Digital Enterprise group. Jeff Lowney came to Intel from Digital Equipment Corporation. He runs our software research lab in Massachusetts. Kevin Kahn, who is an Intel veteran of almost 30 years now?
Over 30 years.
Anyway, Kevin runs the Communications Architecture Lab. He and I had the privilege of working with Kevin, managing the group when we first formed and started to drive all our wireless activities. Ajay Bhatt, Intel Fellow, is director of our I.O. architecture. He's the person in Intel that's spearheading the Geneseo program from the technical point of view, so if you have any Geneseo questions, they're going right to him. Knut Grimsrud, Intel Fellow. Storage architecture, if you like serial ATA, this is the man to blame on Intel's side. He's been driving storage interconnect standards and disk technologies for several years now, right? How many years have you been in Intel?
13.
John Crawford, I always call John Mr. Intel. You know, I tell people at Intel that we owe the lights at Intel to John Crawford and the work that he did on the 386 and Virtual 86 on the 386 machine when we started to migrate from 16-bit code to 32-bit code. He's one of my favorite guys. Raj Javadkar. Raj now is moving over. He comes over from the Systems Technology Lab. He's kind of the jack of all trades. I'll get an email from him that says, I want to talk about networking architectures, and then the next day, hey, we got to talk about power management, and then the next day he starts telling me we have to talk about chassis design. So I don't know what he does, but whatever it does, he's actually very good at it. And he's now migrating over to actually run the architecture for our silicon validation team. Now, last but not least, David Cook. If any of you have a computer science background, this man has influenced you. Either you were one of his students, and I met a guy last night who's pretty old who said he was one of David's students, so I'll leave it at that. Or you had a book that was written by David. I know the first computer architecture book I had was by David, and I was so thrilled when he came to Intel because I got to meet the famous David Cook. David has a team in Illinois that's part of the Cook & Associates that focus on highly parallel programs and in tools and development tools for parallel applications. So with that, let's open it up to questions, and if they're hard questions, I guarantee one of these other guys will probably get to answer it.
Hi, I'm Bill Gervasi with SimpleTech, ex-Intel, 19 years. You guys do a lot of great standards. SATA, USB, PCI Express, but memory doesn't seem to have been a real great forte for you guys. We had RAMBUS, now we have fully buffered DIMM, kind of known as RAMBUS 2. Are you guys going to give up on memory, or do you guys have something else up your sleeves?
If you look at it, JEDEC is the body that has been doing definition for the memory technology for longest time. You picked out an outlier, RAMBUS, you know, there was a different arrangement. But if you look at anything else, it has been, you know, working with JEDEC that people have brought memory technologies to the industry, right? What Intel and some of our partners do usually, you know, if you leave out the RDRAM, is to really bring system requirements, our knowledge of performance, and the platform architecture to that body. We go there with proposal, the DRAM guys show up with what they can build, and that's how most of the DRAMs are done. So there is a body there, we don't need to create yet another body like PCI SIG or USBIF or anything like that.
So I thought I'd also add a secondary answer to your question to at least make sure that you're aware
and that Intel is also collaborating with a bunch of industry partners to create a standardized NAND flash interface. I'm sure one thing that you're really having a lot of fun with on your flash-based devices is the fact that every single flash component you get from different vendors, they all behave slightly differently, and it poses some real design nightmares for you, I'm sure. And so I just want to make you aware that we are pursuing a standard. It's called ONFI. There was, I think that's coming along very nicely, and the collaboration there is fantastic. And so we at least have one area of the memory space, or a new area of memory space, where there's some new standardization effort happening as well, because of the pressing need to get a little bit of control over that. That's kind of a mess right now, and we're trying to clean that up a little bit.
Yeah, I have a question about power management. You've given us some control features in the processors with P states and C states. What about the rest of the system, especially things like memory with FBDIMMs, I/O?
We have a demo here that you'll be able to see on the memory power management, where we can, independent of the operating system, or we can try to do the memory power management by just observing the memory load across multiple DIMMs. In the area of servers, we are also looking at going across the blades within the chassis. So for example, we now have the power management technology, which takes into account not just one blade, but looking across the blades, especially if in a rack, if you see that as you go up in the rack, the heat rises, and the blades above in the rack are more susceptible to increased heat. And so how to migrate the load between the lower level blades, upper level, we have a whole bunch of framework. We're working with other OEMs also on that.
My name is Anand from the Hindu newspaper in Bangalore. The changeover or the switch from dual to quad core has happened so dizzyingly fast. It's only in July that most of the world got to use or got to get to feel dual core, that lay users who at the end of the day form the large majority of Intel's customers, the people who buy PCs for home or the office, small office, they can be pardoned for wondering what on earth they are going to get for these extra four cores. Even now, there are so few applications which are written to make optimal use of dual core. We have to sort of grope around to find products and tools which actually work, or which work better, because they have to be rewritten for double core. And all of a sudden, within 3 months, 6 months, the user community is being pushed, kicking and screaming, into a four-core world. And interestingly enough, it's the first release is a chip which is meant for the gamers and the game developers. The Xeon comes a little later, but by early next year, the rest of the world is being told by Intel, it's dual-core on your machine now. What are they going to get for the extra? What extra value are they going to get? And are there going to be enough applications to justify? I'm sure we, from where I come, we all know that Intel, like any other American company, operates on the principle there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, so they're going to pay a little bit extra for those four cores. What on earth are they going to get, and are they really going to feel a difference for having these four cores put into their machines by early next year?
It is a big challenge, and because, as we all know, for the last 40 years or whatever, the ISVs have just ridden up the faster processors curve. And I know that in the 90s, many companies started thinking about threading their programs, big ones, because I was running a small company then. We had lots of business through lots of OEMs. And so today, indeed, there are not very many scalable apps for the desktop. On the other hand, there are very few ISVs who haven't looked at it, gotten tremendously burned on the average, and said, oh my God, I'm going to put all these locks in there, and I'm going to ship this code, and it works. So one thing that we do find almost everywhere is experienced people at the ISVs who've thought about it, sometimes who say, you've got tools that are going to help this? No way, I don't believe that. So what we've had to do is, Intel has, I don't know, several hundred application engineers who are stationed at all kinds of ISVs. We're actually sending the tool developers out with the AEs to the ISVs, and you have to just kind of take them by the hand and go through this stuff one by one, but it worked. The tools are actually pretty good. We've been working on this stuff for 15 years or something, so by this time, they work pretty well, and There's no magic here, but for, there's lots of people who say, gosh, it's all over because nobody's ever going to do all this work and et cetera. I just don't believe that. The future, I think, of computing is going to be just like the history was. Lots of new stuff. There's a little bit of a change. You don't need every developer to be an expert. You need a couple of developers at each ISV who embrace this technology. Another thing I forgot to mention is Intel has thousands of libraries, IPP and MKL, so technical and sort of non-technical libraries, and those teams together with us have been working for a long time to parallelize all of that stuff. So there's actually a lot of software technology upon which people can build, but it takes a while.
I guess I'd like to comment on this. That so David's describing the technology you need to build a parallel program. I think you're asking, you know, assume we have that, why do you need such a fast computer, basically? And the fact that it's a parallel computer just makes it a little more complicated. But you now have an increasing amount of data on your personal computer. And like, I run this Google desktop search all the time, which means there's this index engine running. And that's something that's looking at all the data on my disk and doing some computation on that.
Okay, I'm Jim Burton from Ideas International. And obviously, we're on a pathway going to multi-cores per socket. I'd like to understand, at what point are we going to hit a wall, or will we have something like a Moore's law that just keeps on scaling up and up and up? And what are some of the technical issues that you're going to be encountering as you go to 16 processors, 13 processors per core, I mean per socket?
So I think we've already discussed a lot of the software issues and touched on a couple some of the system level type of issues. One of the big challenges of the multi-core chip effort at Intel, at least from my perspective, from Intel's perspective, we do processors and we've done them well for a long time. So putting more cores on is more of a step and repeat kind of a challenge. That's the easy part. The hard part is, how do you connect them? How do you interconnect them? How do you feed them data? How do you manage the shared data traffic among various levels of cache on that chip? How you provide bandwidth off chip to memory and to other parts of the system? So that's a big challenge. One of the things we've got going in our favor here is we can learn as we go. So, you know, we know how to do that with one chip. We've done that for a few decades. We've got two chips now, and that brings some issues up. And we've talked about our cache technology that we've built in to make that smarter. And we just need to get smarter and smarter, double our smartness on that interconnect as we go forward. What are the limits? Certainly one limit is power, and that's power in area is limiting us now to 2 and soon to 4. Some of the second order effects in terms of data bandwidth and such is going to be challenges for us to look into, but I'm confident that we'll learn as we go and figure out how to do that and deliver the bandwidth and the communications that's necessary for that.
Morning, I'm Jim Matthews with Matthews Associates, Server Memory Consulting. Thanks for taking time to meet with us and answer our questions, hopefully. In the press, we've heard mention of microbuffers, and I was wondering if you were designing a microbuffer-based RDIMM, what kinds of features would you like to see in that, and how would you position an RDIMM-based system for servers versus fully buffered DIMM-based?
One of the benefits that I don't think is really appreciated by fully buffered DIMM is the fact that your memory reliability goes up exponentially, okay, because now we can test for errors like DIMM unseating problems, because we can check and correct ECC as it comes out of the DIMM itself versus somewhere down the line. Or if the DIMM is bad, we know we're pushing good stuff going forward. So, you know, fully buffered DIMM, so the buffers like that have a good concept. They allow us to increase the capacity of the channel, and they allow us to be able to keep the bandwidth up without adding more and more DIMMs. So, yeah, there are different concepts that we're throwing out and we're looking at. Power is a big issue, as everybody knows. When fully buffered DIMM was specified, it was specified as a server memory, and performance in terms of capacity and bandwidth were paramount. Okay, power being a larger issue, so a lot of the structures, the buffers, and the clocking scheme, on-chip clocking, were defined for that. And we're having to go back in and readdress that. Now, whether that's FBDIM 2, whether that's a new buffer, that's a new version of registered DIM, that we build that into the buffers themselves of the DIMs, whether we merge the PLLs, and PLLs are not easy technologies to deal with. And you want to make sure that, and when you put them on different process technologies, they tend to not behave very well either. So I think there are a lot of different alternatives that we're looking at. I don't think there's a definite answer yet, but you know, certainly the in-memory initiatives that are done in Intel are actually run in my team, and so I have a number of engineers that are focusing on the different problems.
If your philosophy has changed to run as fast as you can, which seems to be what's happened this year, why, as you look to next year, when you've got a new CoreLogic coming out, why aren't your motherboards and your implementation of that technology, why aren't they matching your capabilities?
If you look at how the motherboard business works, usually, you know, these motherboards are highly customized towards OEMs that buy it. So their roadmap and, you know, the SKUs that you see on the web versus, you know, what they sell is a lot different. You know, a lot of times, you know, if you work with some OEM in China or some OEM in Korea, they all have their own configurations. And then Intel, you know, on the website, what you see is the stuff that we sell to retail based on, you know, our analysis. So please don't equate, you know, the progress on our lack of progress on the motherboard side with, you know, our roadmap. They just try to follow the business model that they work with.
Yeah, and kind of to build up on that, to see if I interpreted your question correctly. You know, it all depends on the economies of those businesses. The, you know, there are certain technologies, for example, there are certain technologies that we've had around for a long time that we've got a great infrastructure in our factories to be able to take advantage of. We can turn products based on those technologies really quickly. And then when you look at the needs of the particular segment that that we're trying to address, some technologies and migrating those technologies to faster processors, different cores, et cetera, are more important than, say, in changing other parts of the subsystem. So really what it ends up being is focusing on what makes sense for that particular business segment, change what really needs to be changed, because when you have to go through and you have to change that whole validation infrastructure, which is why I'm glad Raj is working on validation. Validation is a big problem. Every time we change something, the amount of suites we have to run to make sure that we run software that was written 10 or 15 years ago becomes horrendous. And we're trying to improve that. So we try to change as little as possible. When it makes economic sense to change, we'll make that transition.
Hi, John Mashey, TechVisor, never an Intel person. two quick questions, one on memory and one on back on parallelism. The memory one is SO DIMMs in laptops. As an old systems guy, it makes me nervous to have a couple gigs of memory and no ECC, for instance. Right? Can you guys address that? Should I be getting nervous? You know, are the numbers getting better? And again, in the old days, that much memory, we'd worry a lot, right? And the second one is back to the parallelism thing, maybe for David. You know, beyond the classic technical codes that you worked on for so many years, can you sort of sort what you're seeing in terms of progress in different application spaces? Like, I'm not really expecting Word real quick to be, you know, parallelized, right? But if you can sort of sort through the applications where you see people making progress, that would be good.
So it turns out in DRAM technology, the scaling of reliability has followed pretty much the scaling of the cells. In other words, the failure rate per chip has stayed pretty constant over the last 10, 15 years or so. So you really shouldn't be concerned about the number of bits you have. You really should be concerned how many chips you have, which really hasn't changed, and if anything, maybe it's come down a bit. So that's that's one thing to keep in mind. That's in contrast to static RAM technology, where the failure per bit's been more or less constant. You know, if you had SRAM in your laptop, you'd have a much cause for concern. But the DRAM cells, for various reasons, maybe the most important one is they've got a big capacitor there to hold a lot of charge. It's a per chip thing. It's not a per cell thing.
Yeah, my question was based on the comments you made on Geneseo, there was a talk about opening the front side bus to allow FPGAs to interconnect with them. Where do you see the accelerators adding value, considering the fact that we are rapidly moving towards multi-core processors? We are incorporating SSE4 instructions that can help take over some of the advanced processing. So how do we decide on which applications should be handed over to an accelerator, and rather than coding in the main processor architecture? And secondly, where do you see the accelerators impacting the multi-threading model? So I don't want to have an accelerator that accelerates one thing and then completely destroys my threading model and makes the processors less optimal.
So I think one answer to your question is we think accelerators can plug in to areas where there's very computationally intensive, and where it's more of a fixed or it's a fairly small-defined or well-defined, not quite fixed function, but a very well-defined computation. Maybe talk about image processing or some an awful lot of intensive scientific kind of computation where the it's more computation intensive and not so memory intensive. So we see those kind of areas. And the answer to the other question, one of the things we're focused on and why we think it's important for us to drive this communication standard is that we can then provide smooth integration with our processors to avoid the serial bottleneck and keep it working well.
You get. Yeah. Just a general observation, and I mean, ultimately, of course, it's the guy who's off thinking he can build and sell a accelerator profitably who has to make this choice, right? But I will make a general observation. You really want to stay out of the way of the juggernaut, if you will, of the central CPU performance advance, unless you have a very good reason for understanding why the accelerator gives you value. And there are some, but historically, you got to choose carefully. So reasons for choice, very specific logic that because of its nature allows you to do something in a parallel manner that is not replicatable in any easy way serially, and therefore you get an inherent performance improvement. Something where dedicated logic has a big power differential to you. Where the general purpose stuff, even with all the work we're doing on power efficient processing, is simply not going to give you the power advantage that you get out of doing it in an accelerator. Bad reasons to do it, I think, are that you see a brief moment in time where you can be 20% faster. My favorite example of this is TOW, which has kind of reappeared time after time after time, to TCP offload stuff. And every time it shows up, you just have to stand around for about 6 or 8 months, and the central system goes right by you. One of my favorite things to point out to people is that in this industry, particularly regarding CPU performance, performance equals time. And so if you move your product introduction by a few months, your performance equation has radically changed. I mean, you're seeing that certainly as the comment earlier on single core, dual core, quad core. So I think you really have to look carefully at the unique value that an accelerator brings. There clearly are some, but be cautious that it's not just a point in time performance window that's going to close on top of you very quickly.
My name's Sam Carswell from Formation. I have a Robson question. We design embedded servers that are running Windows, and that marketplace lags the rest of the marketplace by a few years because of its using ETX form factors, et cetera, the compact PCI. But we'd like to see Robson right away. It makes a big difference in our marketplace with slow disks. So I saw yesterday's diagram showed the SATA drive, the serial ATA driver, and Robson, and there's this little line going between them. What kind of problems are either business or software problems will I have trying to bring Robson to an existing serial ATA Windows platform that's running Vista, but the rest of that hookup?
The driver architecture for the initial Robson solution is a little bit interesting architecture because the Robson cache does not sit on the same bus that it's caching. Robson sits off a PCI. and the storage device hangs off of serial ATA. As a result, the driver architecture becomes a little bit interesting. And like you saw in that picture you're referring to, there's a Robson driver, there's a serial ATA driver, and the two drivers essentially communicate with each other. So storage requests that are heading down the serial ATA stack, they get intercepted, and they get diverted to the Robson stack based on the caching policies that are there. We're not aware of any issues with that driver model with Microsoft Vista. And from what I understand from various announcements and so on from Microsoft is that they're indicating that there aren't any barriers to Robson being supported on Vista and having all the various kinds of whatever their approvals and logos and things like that are. And so there really aren't any barriers to that all working. And I think you saw all the demos and so on were done on Vista in the class earlier.
Anyway, we are getting the hook. I appreciate everybody coming and spending some time with us.